This is No Direction's PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage. PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage was made possible thanks to the support of the Roll for Combat podcast, as well as the dedication of our team of volunteers. Due to possibly questionable language, this panel is rated Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Hi there, everybody.
Howdy.
Welcome to Designing Pathfinder Monsters. We'll start up here with some introductions. I am Amanda Hammond-Coons. I'm developing managing developer for Starfinder.
I'm Adam Nagle. I'm managing developer for Pathfinder.
And I'm Logan Bonner. I'm a designer.
So we're going to start out this panel by talking a little bit about this creation up here that our artist, Gus Bonner, Taylor Fisher, has so gracefully drawn and displayed up here for us. So we thought we would talk a little bit about some general monster design techniques for just role-playing games, system agnostic considerations, and then maybe go into a little bit about some specific rules elements for Pathfinder 1 that we might apply to this creature here, and then some specific Pathfinder elements that we might apply from 2nd edition to this particular creature. So I'm going to start a little bit about some general monster design concepts. What do you guys, I'll throw this to the panel first, what do you guys think makes a compelling threat monster? What are some very basic considerations that you start out with when you are coming up with a new monster or people's characters fight?
I think a good blend of something that presents fear in a good narrative sense. That, and this is something that we explored earlier, came up in the previous thing, is like basically the full package of something that is scary, that intimidates people, and has the numbers to back it up.
Yeah, that's right.
I like things that are really evocative, that like when you see it, you get some idea of what it's going to do to you, and then it does that, and it's even worse when it does. something that's like when you look at it, it's like, I think this is how to fight it, and that usually your instincts are going to pay off. When you're encountering a monster, or you know, I should not touch that. And if you do touch it, yeah, you're right. You shouldn't have touched it.
So seeing your death coming from you is a strategy that you. I like that. That's very straightforward. That's better than the cute, fluffy little creature that then grows 10 times its size and has giant fangs and they eat you, but you just wanted to pet it.
Yeah, you do. I think you do a few of those, but they're best served seldom. Most of the monsters should be like, oh yeah, we get it. We don't like it, but we get what's happening.
Sure. So what about monsters from like a canon sort of in-world setting? Adam, you have done a lot of adventure path development. You were our back matter monster guy for such a long time. Logan, you've also worked a lot with adventures and developing as well. Can you guys talk a little bit about when there's a new monster or there's an encounter that needs a specific type of monster, what are some of the considerations that you think of or what you think makes it compelling for players and for GMs? It makes it sort of stand out.
One of the things that I like to do as far as like setting is have the monster make sense, that it fits with its environment, the things it's doing have a reason that makes sense. Like, because I think a juxtaposed monster just kind of takes everyone out of the...
Yeah.
Fear.
Yeah, one that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I like to start by kind of saying, what are the other monsters in a similar spot to this? So like if you're traveling through a snowy mountain, it's like, we know there are yetis, we know there are these other kind of cold, mountainous creatures. What's something that isn't being served by those existing monsters? To make sure that it's something that's not like, why wasn't this just blank? So I think it's that can make it kind of a little more exciting when it's like, oh, I see why this is here. And you can kind of see how it slots into everything else.
Sure, sure. I think a lot of times putting in a specific new monster or a specific tweaked existing monster can oftentimes be fodder for having a lot of inspiration come at you from various different sources, you know, whether it's mythology, whether it's pop culture, whether it's some specific... just type of literature thing that you're into. What are some of your guys' favorite inspirations when you're looking at creating monsters?
Kind of went over this in the last hour, but folklore is mainly a thing. But one thing that I have been kind of doing in the last couple of years is just finding blind spots or gaps in rules as far as encounter design. Mm-hmm. So monsters have to fill those challenges, which is an approach that I didn't start off taking whenever I started making monsters.
Sure.
Yeah, I think for mythology, you get kind of that like visceral thing where it's like, yeah, people have been afraid of this for thousands of years. I think on the other end of that is something like video games, where you get a really good sense of like, what is it like to fight this thing in a very tangible sense? Like, oh, you need to dodge it in this particular way to avoid things. So you're thinking about it in terms of action rather than just numbers. So it's like, yes, if I step up to this and hit it five times in a row, that's good. But if you kind of look at things that are kind of more action-oriented, you get a little more sense of like, what are some different approaches you use to fighting things? So you can kind of give them, their paper, rock, paper, scissors of fighting the monster. It's good against this, it's bad against this. And that kind of gives you a little more perspective to make the fight feel different than all the other fights.
Sure, yeah. I'm a big fan of drawing inspiration from just various franchises and series and properties that I'm a fan of personally. And I'm really kind of looking at the concept of why I like those two types of monsters and seeing, are there elements of those that make sense for a role-playing game and they don't already exist, in the role-playing game, and sort of just, turning it into a way that is very kind of uniquely Pathfinder or whatever it is that I bring, while it still sort of has roots in that concept.
And maybe taking a couple different things and
mashing it together.
Or say, oh, I like this monster. What monsters would it work with in our setting? And kind of say, oh, it would totally hang out with fire giants. So let's kind of build this culture so that it matches with them.
Yeah.
And I think that's generally a really cool thing for monsters. When you kind of say, what's its reach beyond just itself? Mm-hmm. So who does it hang out with? What important locations might it appear in? And then after we beat it, what does that lead to? What kind of treasure is it going to give us? Or what kind of clues is it going to give us? What kind of wider world is it going to give us a window into?
Yeah.
I think all that stuff can really make it feel like it's more than just I am Mog, so to speak, that it really has a place in the world and gives you more inspiration even after it's gone.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a really big fan of doing that in adventure locations, so specifically kind of dungeon crawl type of things or big open, full page map situations instead of just finding a monster that is of the appropriate CR of the adventure I'm writing. I try to look for a monster that would make sense to be there and kind of come up with a backstory in my head of why that creature has been there, why is that working with the other creatures that live there, it's an intelligent creature, what is its motivation, what's it trying to accomplish, and then have sometimes that will spawn little role-playing scenarios in the adventure, which people tend to say they find that kind of thing more interesting than just the face of the mob.
Yeah, it's the part that ends up being more memorable.
Yeah.
It's not we fought the Roper and we kicked its butt, but it's that Roper was really good friends with the Etten two rooms down, and Alcat is really mad that we killed the Roper, and then so he acted towards us in this way, and that kind of is the stuff that people really remember more than I hit it, two crits, it was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be memorable, but I think having a connection.
Yeah, those memories tend to fade, though. They tend to be great convention stories when, 2 days ago you just critted twice in a row, but when you remember, that the Etten came charging after you and hunted you throughout your entire adventure because you killed his rover buddy and it wanted revenge, and then you had to deal with that, that's a way more memorable scenario that is a story that you're going to tell over and over. And that's really what we're trying to do as RPG writers, right, is make memorable experiences for people.
I've been cycling since you were talking about what you coming up with ideas that make the monster make sense, and we're talking to you, what do you defeat it, what do you get, what treasure do you take with you? And I was like, what if it's not treasure you take with you? What if you're just cursed?
Curses and diseases.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
Yep.
Talk about remembering a thing and not wanting to. Anyway,
keeps on giving. So do we want to move a little bit more into this, this particular creature that's up there? Great.
I kept cycling up trying to, but Rain won't get off trying to name it. But names are hard, and I always try to do the hard thing first, so.
Just for your workflow, so you can step on it later.
Yeah, yeah. First thing, there's only so much cognitive ability.
Right. The widow.
We got a spider.
Yeah, so, those are pustules that whenever you break them, newly baby spiders come out, which is kind of like a hesitation to, you want to hurt it, but if you hurt it in the wrong way, then it's worse.
Yeah, for sure. Let's
see. So I want to mention something for Pathfinder 2, because we had a monster that kind of, no big spoilers, but there's a monster that you will encounter that has a little bit of a function, somewhat like that. But because of the way Pathfinder 2 works, you get up to 3 attacks per round and everything, and criticals are a little bit easier to get, so we had it trigger if you critically hit it. So something like that doesn't work quite as well in first edition, because at lower levels that can be hard to do, and at higher levels it can be really, really easy to do. But in second edition, it would be something like, if we trigger that on a critical hit, it pops one of those pods. Then you know it's happening fairly often, but not necessarily every turn. Mm-hmm. So that works really well there. We probably want to do a little different solution for that in first edition. And like, you can also do like damage types, right? It's a good place for like, yeah, bludgeoning is probably not going to pop one of these as easily as slashing.
Right.
Something to come to play with for that type of monster. So you can kind of be like, stop using that.
Yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about just sort of the balance of monster design and kind of maybe looking at this critter for kind of a metric, but you know, that's a big consideration, of course, of first edition Pathfinder, but also of second edition when you're looking at balancing things within the systems to make sure that the encounters are working as intended and not being too easy or too difficult. What are some of the things that you guys would that you would do to kind of make sure that this creature kind of makes sense from a
I think the first thing we'd look at is kind of like, just since we're basing on the art, right, we look at what size it is. So if that's the size of a human head, then this is probably large, maybe huge.
There was a call in the last one to make it gargantuan, and you see the...
Oh, okay.
It doesn't have to be, though.
It's just and part of it is, sizes usually start appearing at different levels. So if it's large, it probably appears at a lower minimum level than if it's huge. Then if it's gargantuan, it's probably appearing up in the early teens. If it's not like just a big, you know, mammoth or something, it might appear lower. But if it's this kind of monster, it's probably appearing at those higher levels if it's gargantuan. And then when you're doing that, then it's like, okay, what role does it serve in the world, kind of determines what type of campaign you want to use it in.
Not in regards to size, as far as the balance goes, I do admit that I'm kind of a right bastard, that I undervalue CR a bit in my monster design, because there's a lot of pushovers, and I want it to mean something. But I mean, like, at the core, monster design in Pathfinder 1 is one of your most important and valuable things is table 1-1 in the bestiary. It's got the guidelines, and I'm going to stress guidelines, because I've had people go, well, those things AC is like too higher than what it says for CR4. Yeah, guidelines, not hard and fast rule. You can wiggle with some of that thing. So just using that table is one of the things I go for balance, and then you can adjust the numbers, but make sure that if you adjust anything too much in one way, you compensate it for it in another. Like,
when you create a strength for it, you need to create a weakness somewhere else,
right?
Based on the monster's thing.
Like high AC, drop those hit points a little bit.
Unless it's supposed to be just the most durable thing in the world, then maybe it's like its attacks aren't quite as strong, but it's hard to do.
It's dumb as a rock.
Dumb as a rock. Doesn't have a lot of options. Like this one is probably going to have some pretty significant special abilities. So depending on how strong those are, you probably weaken some of its like just plain attacks more. You kind of point it toward what you want it to be primarily doing. So that's kind of the strongest part of the monster. Like, what does it want to achieve? That's what it's best at. What it doesn't really want to be doing is
One of the things that with this that you have to think about as far as, and maybe I'm jumping ahead to like special abilities, but like if when you pop one of those blisters, it makes another critter, that's something you have to look at the design of that ability closely for, because it could make an encounter get real unwieldy real fast.
Yeah.
Like in 3.5, there was the rabbit that can just animate objects all day.
Yeah.
And it's just like, thanks, you just made the GM a huge headache.
Yeah.
And frustrated party members. It's like, okay, we got it. Oh, look, there's another thing. This is great. Hey, Bob, can we just stop right now?
Yeah. Can we just say he stops making things?
So, for example, for this one, you could say, like, all right, if you pop open one of these pustules, one of those head things drops out. and each of them can mimic one specific person. So if it's fighting a party of four people, you know it kind of has an effective maximum. And if you keep popping out those, they're just like mannequin heads. They're just, they're nothing. But if it mimics people, then, you know, you kind of have a limit set in there. And if it happens to be in the town square, then if you don't have a limit, try not to let that happen.
That's a slightly creepy twist to that.
Yeah. Ooh. Oh my god, Ogun, what happened?
Like a wishing well that's spouting heads in the water.
How pleasant.
There might be towns that are into that.
Yeah.
I'm
not judging.
very narcissistic town. They're just like, I just want another one.
Yeah, right. Logan, you brought up a really, you guys brought up a really interesting point about, you know, if you are following that table in the bestiary and you have one value that's a lot higher, or, you know, reasonably higher than one, that you need to drop something else. And sort of philosophically, I think that holds true for other types of aspects, like, you know, resistances and defenses, immunities and things like that, but also keeping in mind the pacing of the encounters that you'll have with that monster can be really important, because I've seen designers understand that concept but not really understand why it's important, and so they'll do things like, they'll give the monster a really high AC, and to compensate for that, they'll give it, you know, like low hit points but a whole bunch of resistance. It's like, well, that's really just going to prolong the encounter and make it boring and not fun, and that's not really the purpose of why that really exists.
Yeah, and it also leads to things like, if you have a monster that's really hard to damage, like I said earlier, you make it hard to damage, but its attacks aren't as good. Well, it needs to have interesting things to do, or it's just going to be a thing that you fail to hit, and then it hits you back, and nobody's actually going to have fun with that, right? There needs to be a point of interest that keeps the encounter engaging.
Right, because the GM is a player as well, and so you want the GM to look at the monster and be like, oh, look at all these cool abilities that I can have it do, instead of just, you know, just hitting every once in a while, and then the GM is playing that creature trying to get off those cool abilities before the encounter ends, and keeping in mind that most monsters are on stage really for about 3 rounds, sometimes 2, sometimes 4, sometimes 1, and so also not overloading of the whole bunch of abilities that you never get to use, because it's a CR2 creature with 6 special abilities and 5 spell-like abilities.
And spell-like abilities can really be just like, oh, yeah, it kind of makes sense that it has these, but we included 8 of them.
And they're just not as
there's no focus in them. And some of those, like, if it's something that it needs to do outside of combat, that kind of thing, especially if you're building a monster for home, you can just write those in a separate spot, because it's like, this is not really its combat ability. It has this because it would make sense for it to have it. But you can kind of separate things out so that this is strong enough that it wants to be using it in a fight. This is something that takes, you know, a minute to cast or whatever, so it's not really a combat thing. And I don't need to worry about this when I'm running a monster. But it might factor into its backstory. That's a good of the adventure.
So we talked about the pustule ability that it has, right? Popping out heads, weird gross heads, that mimic party members. That's super cool. That's a very evocative, very visual ability that this monster has. And maybe that's its only thing.
I know what the heads do.
Oh, what do the heads do?
They start blathering all your innermost secrets.
Interesting. Do they attack? Maybe it's a sonic attack.
I don't know. I just know what they're saying. So it's like, these are maybe not the biggest threat, but I want that to stop talking. I'm going to grapple it.
Close its mouth.
I'm not only terrified, I'm embarrassed.
This monster has humiliated me.
You're marked.
Okay.
You guys were talking about ongoing effects of an encounter, whether that's a curse or a treasure or whatever. And my wife just reminded me of a green gem that we carried around that was sort of a magnet for random encounters. It occurs to me that if, you know, sometimes these pustules burst and you just have a pheromone trail now that makes you more attractive to whatever other monster happens to be in this dungeon or adventure.
It makes you delicious.
Yeah.
Smell tasty. Let's maybe we'll just talk for a couple more minutes about like abilities or whatever, and then we'll open up to questions, because it sounds like people are getting some ideas. Anything else that you would give this monster to make it an interesting encounter for either Pathfinder 1 or Pathfinder 2? Or either. like there's, it's got mandibles. Maybe it had some poison.
Why don't we talk about kind of its attack routine? Because that's one thing that's kind of different in the two editions.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
And you can speak to Pathfinder 1 also, Pathfinder 2.
Yeah, so what natural, this thing would have natural attacks, looks like.
It's certainly have a bite. Poison could be a good rider for that as well. Also, with its grossness, a disease makes sense, but that's usually kind of a, not an immediate deal. And
right.
It goes a little longer, unless you want to kind of mess with, kind of blur the lines between poison and disease, which
sure.
is possible.
That's also one of those places where you might see, like, these would both make sense. What do I want to focus on? And so
right.
you narrow it down to, like, whichever of those options is the strongest.
Yeah.
Because a lot of monsters have, like, a poison and a disease, but sometimes it's better to be like, we're going to focus on this to make room for other abilities.
Yeah, yes. And quite frankly, I mean, I've kind of gotten bored of ability damage as the result of poison or disease.
Yeah.
So if I were doing this, I would try to make it something at least more interesting, even if it's not that debilitating.
Yeah, even if it's just like you start growing pustules.
Right.
Or
some sort of acute confusion-based effect or some sort of mental effect or something like that. Yeah, that would be cool. It seems like maybe this thing might be like CR8 or CR9 or some sort of like mid-tier kind of thing.
I don't know how big we made it. But
yeah.
I think it would be more interesting in the like 7 to 12 range for sure.
Yeah, right. So probably like a bite claw pull off from Pathfinder 1, maybe poison on the bite, special ability. I could see it having some sort of like drip or some sort of.
Its little head babies were a little more durable. It wouldn't need more than like because
those can attack.
Yeah, for sure.
They can run up, jump on your
bite.
Just make the bite good and poke. Have
it's
a rider with it, and then
it's also one where
make it easy to pop a head baby.
Yeah, it's also one where you have to look at kind of the level you get fly and that kind of thing. It's like to decide like can this fly. Or if the PCs are able to fly and it's ground based, you have to, you want to put it at a level where not everybody can just avoid it entirely.
Yeah. Logan, do you want to do some Pathfinder 2 talk
about attack? So, one of the things with Pathfinder 2 is we don't do as many attack routines. So, usually each individual attack has kind of a specific use. The main thing there is we have the agile trait, which means that the iterative attacks, so to speak, don't reduce as much. So normally your first attack doesn't take a penalty, your second attack takes a minus 5, and your third and any further attacks take a minus 10. Agile is minus 0, minus 4, minus 8 instead. So what we usually do is like the bite is the high damage one, and then like the claws or legs in this case are the agile one that doesn't do as much damage but is more likely to hit. So it's still probably going to try to bite you and then try to smack you with its claws or its legs, but it's kind of built so that you don't have to do that in order to kind of do its full attack, so to speak. So that's kind of just one of the differences between the two editions. And we also sometimes give monsters like special attacks where it spends two actions and it attacks everybody around it with a leg, and it's just kind of more of a specific attack technique that that monster does. And that kind of varies from monster to monster based on its theme.
Is there anything else you want to talk about this cipher before we open up to questions?
I think it might also be interesting, like if it bites you, like if it has to get your blood in order to kind of program its pustules.
Yeah,
it bites you and then you see like a little Valoros head appears, you know, it's kind of reshapes into Valoros's drunken face.
You can also see that being kind of a one-a-day thing that's like, you know, once the GM gets to decide once it's absorbed, you know, enough attacks from PCs, how many hits does it sort of out, that sort of becomes the focus of the encounter.
I definitely see this, you know, not just a dumb monster, it's got some intelligence.
I think so, yeah. I think it's got some strategy behind it, even if it's trying to, like, ward in the PCs to attack it. Yeah. Okay, I think we'll go ahead and open up to questions. I'll start seeing some hands over here. We'll start with the gentleman all the way in the back.
If that creature does have some intelligence and strategy, wouldn't it be able to choose to pop a head baby?
Might be able to. We would
that
definitely
could be an ability.
You definitely need a limit, like how many times you can do it, depending on how strong the heads are, basically.
It also might be, that might be on like the rough weapon type of.
So many rounds or recharges. Yeah. Who else did we have in the hands? That gentleman in the middle?
that hypothetical monster from earlier that was the damage sponge with weak attacks and just goes on forever and is boring. You can also give it weaknesses by giving it strengths too, right? Like if you gave that monster, which has ridiculously high AC, low hit points, so it sucks to try to hit it, and it's got weak attacks, so it sucks when it hits you. If you gave it Swallow Whole, right, and it swallows a barbarian or a fighter, now all of a sudden it doesn't have high AC anymore, and yeah, whatever's in it with the light weapon is just cutting its way out easily. Every round they're getting full attack on its side.
Yeah, right. Like a little trick to get by the problem.
And it's like, and it's way cool, right, because the GM still gets to go, yeah, I'm swallowing a player with this thing, like, whole, they are in it. And the player's like, oh, what do? I guess we try to cut out. It's like, whoa, now this fight's really easy from inside the thing.
We also did something with the animated objects in second edition where they have kind of, you know, this hard outer shell because they're objects. But once you smash through that, then they kind of, you know, like the exterior kind of cracks off and then they're easier to hit because their kind of armor is gone, essentially. If you're fighting like an animated statue or something like that, you kind of crack it open and then have an easier time. So the fight starts out just like, oh my god, this thing will not take any damage, and then you get to a point where the style of the encounter kind of changes, and it's like, oh my god. You get a moment of relief, which is nice in a monster fight.
Yeah, right, but you're starting to feel like it's futile, and this thing is going to destroy us, and all of a sudden it's starting to take damage and get... Yeah. Let's go with the gentleman in the middle, right there.
So going with that sort of venom stealing knowledge and forming heads and secrets, I kind of like the idea of them being able to gain knowledge skills from people, or having a few knowledge skills on their own, and being able to even share that information with people. Maybe they have this way where they can bestow knowledge by maybe even a bite attack, but it gives a boon, so it's unsettling, where even if it's the minion of a boss that uses an informant, or even the party has to approach it, because maybe it took someone's information and that person died, so now in a creepy campaign, this is your NPC contact that you have to talk to. So like the idea of being able to share information, the idea of a benevolent aberration is something that every RPG is like critically short of.
Yeah, it's like good news is that information is still around. Bad news is it's on the back of this spider and you have to go get it.
This actually reminds me of the Nathalgum.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So like that is kind of the... Like, you could kind of set up a dichotomy where that's kind of the evil one that collects brains, and this is the one that's like, I'm just going to give you a little nibble, and then I'm going to throw a head that looks just like yours, but it's fine.
It's fine.
You get it, right?
So it's like got heads of, like, scholars and then floating in the bags and stuff, but it's kind of like giving advice.
Let's see. This gentleman up front here.
Yeah, more of a general question. I've noticed with a lot of the different, racial hit dice, a lot of them are obviously a lot weaker than others, and it makes building, say, a melee fey really hard, or a knowledge or rogue-like construct really hard. What's the usual way you deal with that?
That's a tough thing.
A lot of extra hit dice.
The thing that's tough about it is, oh great, I've got to pick 9 feats for this thing. That's awesome. I don't want to do that.
Improved initiative, toughness, again.
Yeah. Well, there's also, that's the other thing with monsters, and the NPCs in general. Yeah. Like, there's a suite of things that you need to give them to actually get them to hit their numbers that they need to, and it's frustrating.
There's also some of the special abilities, like what's it called, the one that like adds charisma to your saving throws. It gets used pretty often.
Right.
Then, like,
Right caps have a flat damage bonus. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Yeah. It's easy to do that with monsters.
A lot of the monsters just kind of have new ability that adds to all its numbers.
Yep.
Lucky monster.
It's like its numbers are higher because we say they're higher because we need them to be higher for this game to work correctly. let's see. I saw a hand right there.
Back to this creature, it'd be interesting if there was a little bit more synergy between the little heads that come off and then it's actually the other creature. So something like maybe the heads don't really do that much damage, but they apply penalties that either make, like, give negatives to saves or something versus the spell abilities of the mother.
Yeah, or they grab onto you and kind of constrict you and restrict your movement and lower your speed.
So the babies make it easier for mom to get.
Yeah. Go, my children. Do my will. Let's see, who else we got up front here?
Earlier, you both mentioned diseases and poisons and kind of over the ability damage. So, Pathfinder 2 question. Are we moving sort of in the way of Pathfinder Unchained for that, or is there a new way to handle diseases and poisons?
There are a few different things. One is that there are some conditions that kind of replicate some of the effects. So, Enfeebled is kind of like strength damage in that it gives penalties to those things, but you don't have to calculate everything out. It just kind of says these are the things that it matters for, and those get penalties. And we also have, in the case of poison, we have poison as a damage type. So if it is just going to do hit point damage, you can do that with poison as well.
What else do we got? I saw some hands over there. Right there.
So I was wondering, like, at what point in the process do you like to sit down and you're like, all right, where does this thing live? Is it an extra planner? Like, what's its environment? How do you affect it?
Usually, because of the way we make products, that's usually one of the first things that happens. Because we're either saying this adventure is set here, and so it needs to live here, or we're saying for a bestiary, we're looking for, like, we figure out, like, the first three core things of the monster, where it's like, what's its type, what's its level band, what's its environment. And those are usually some of the first questions that get answered. And usually, like, if you're doing one for your home game, you kind of have an idea of what you want your campaign to be like. So you're usually figuring out where the monster slots in that. So it's usually very early on in the process.
Or numbers or abilities, you can really come into it that much, yeah.
Yeah, and for like a whole book of monsters, we'll pay very close attention to, let's make sure that we have, you know, enough monsters across the spread of level bands, of types. You know, maybe the bestiary has a theme, and so we're going to do a bunch of creatures along that theme, but we also want to make sure that we have enough aberrations, and we want to make sure we have enough outsiders, and we want to make sure we have enough monsters, humanoids. Yeah, some aquatic creatures, creatures that are just very useful so that GMs who have that book, you know, we don't want the whole book to be all looking at evil dragons, because they don't care about evil dragons, but they don't need the book.
Yeah, and usually our particular bestiaries, we try to do them fairly broad rather than, like, in theory you could do, here's a tightly themed one, and this is all creatures from the plane of fire, but we usually don't do that kind of thing just because we want to kind of have them feel like a bestiary in the sense of it's expansive and covers a whole lot of different things.
Yeah, and then for adventures, like Logan was saying, we try to let the story drive what we think is the most appropriate for, you know, what type of creature would be here, what type of creature would be opposing the PC, what type of creature, you know, just lives here in the environment and therefore is a threat, and what type of creature might have traveled here for a specific reason, and those types of things.
And usually those try to have a mix, so it's not just all one note, where like each volume of an AP is usually going to have like one in that latter category that just kind of lives here, and a more kind of story-centric one based on the plot line. Instead of just like, well, these all are crucial to the story, there's nothing else.
Yeah, we really want to try to make sure that all those creatures in the bestiary of the back of the AP, for example, can show up in like random encounter tables. We can have some way to tie that content into the adventure, so it's not just a cool creature that doesn't get used.
But that happens every now and then.
Every once in a while, especially when it's a really cool creature.
Yes.
We want to publish this thing.
Yeah,
or we had something we couldn't publish before, and we just had space, right. So we put it in.
There's also the occasional creature where it's like, we know nobody's ever going to use the stat block, but we want to present this creature, and part of our presentation of the creature is not just its story, but its stats.
So we need this to look important.
This is a level 17 monster, and nobody's going to use a stat block, but I have to design it and pick all its feats. But you know, that's kind of part of making it feel like it's a
problem. Yeah, for sure.
On the topic of feats, you can actually kind of use special feat chains to add special abilities in a way. Though it was a human, one of the most interesting fights I've ever ran was the parties on a small platform, fighting a single person. They have combat patrol, combat reflexes, pushing assault, so they try to get in and pushes them back. You guys might know what fight I'm talking about. But so for a creature like this, you could give it breadth of knowledge. To represent what it's stolen and learned from people, so it can make every knowledge check, every profession check.
Yeah.
I once wrote an aberration that had a cosmopolitan, because they learned to interact with people in their own way, and each one would learn whatever specialized language for location, whatever location it lived in. So in its own way, you could hint towards the monster's approach to things, or how it interacts with the world, just by telling this little story with the weak choices.
Yeah, that's really fun, is to tell a little internal narrative with the design choices and sort of see what people do with that, and if you're reading through playback posts, it's really fun for me to see how people are using some of these monsters, because it's like, oh, they totally figured out that I dropped in these little hints that this thing, you know, originally came from the ethereal plane and, you know, was trying to get back there, or, you know, whatever. So, right there.
It's actually a question about second edition, so I don't know how you can answer it. Or how much you can say, I'm sure you can answer that. So, one of the big problems with first edition, when you have, like, even a CR appropriate monster, right, you have five party members and one thing, so it comes down to action economy is a real problem. You know, this thing only gets so many different things it can do, and then five people each get a chance to do a bunch of things to get, and it just ends up getting circumvented a lot of the time without inviting people to do other types of things. So, does second edition kind of work on that action economy thing and change things up a little bit more?
It's still, the monsters use the same three actions per turn as PCs do, generally speaking. But because of the way that action economy is structured, you don't have as much, like, I can only take a 5-foot step if I want a full attack. So a lot of monsters that are kind of based around a lot of attacks are going to have some more flexibility with that, so they don't get kind of locked in place, which can be another big problem. First edition is just kind of static fights because nobody wants to move because they don't want to get their attacks in. And it's just, you know, it's really good to have the PC fighters to all be surrounding them so they don't have to move either. And then the monsters can have special actions that let them attack multiple times with one action or attack everybody with two actions or things like that. We are mindful of it, but we also don't want to make it so that the monsters just kind of follow a completely different set of rules from the PCs. So yeah, it's kind of a mix, and we're, you know, going to kind of play test it and make sure that works. The other thing that's helping some is if you're fighting a higher level monster, which is more likely to be a boss, then we generally give the expansion and hit points from level to level is a little higher, so it's probably going to live a little bit longer than its counterpart would have. And there are also just fewer things that just destroy you outright. And so I think there's some kind of mitigating factors for some of the kind of solo type monsters.
See, we're doing that, and then we'll get you in the back.
I actually had a question about, I guess this is in response to what Adam said. You talked about using new rule sets as ways to flesh out monsters or come up with monsters. Does that ever become an accessibility problem? Like, oh, here's this really cool feat or ability for this monster, but it's from this one book that's not tied to this campaign. Is that a limiting factor?
I tried not.
For publication, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, for publication.
For home use.
Yeah, for publication, it's certainly a problem. Like, we don't assume that anyone has anything, you know, like from people of the North or whatever.
Right.
Especially for stuff in the core, we kind of stick to stuff that's in the PRD, and then usually one or two sources per monster beyond the core world of the
SRE. But to add to that, actually, earlier today there was a conversation, and Ron Lundin, one of our new developers, was talking about he was developing a monster that was using a feat from, you know, some player companion or something like that. Or, no, it was a spell. And they had it as one of their spell-like abilities for this monster, and he was just like, well, it wasn't really doing exactly what they were going for, of wanting the monster to do, so he plucked the important parts out of that and came up with a new monster ability.
Yeah,
you know, just kind of like, scrub the parts off you don't need, polish it up a little bit, and boom.
Sometimes it means you're like, well, I don't know what to give for some of the feet, because I turned this feet into a special ability, but usually there's always toughness. Whichever one you have
already given. Or boosters or whatever. Yeah.
The current initiative.
We had a question in the middle or back there. Okay, yeah.
When you're designing monsters, what sort of strategies do you guys use to encourage players to do something that's not just get in there and start full attacking this creature until it dies?
Mm-hmm. I like to do things that obscure what the monster is, where it is, and why it's doing what it's doing. So I like to start either encounters or just kind of seed encounters throughout the adventure. If I've got a really compelling monster that I want, you know, to last more than 2 rounds of their full attacking it, and try to, you know, give little hints that maybe this monster is tracking them, or maybe this monster, you know, is trying to get information about them, or maybe this monster is just kind of around in the area and they're going to be encountering it at some point. And sort of just give little drips and drops without necessarily revealing exactly what's going on. And then, you know, having the PCs, as PCs do, get very curious and start maybe doing not so smart things, like kind of poking into the bushes or kind of trying to make knowledge checks based on these things that they're finding. And then, you know, give a little bit of question into it. If they make their knowledge check or if they don't quite make their knowledge check, if it's within that band of questionableness, just be like, well, you think that this, like, might be a basalt scale, but you're not really sure. Like, you haven't really seen something like this before. You've only read about it. And then they are all kind of like, oh, gosh, maybe there's a basalt here, but maybe there's something else. Maybe it's another big lizard creature or something. And then just sort of, like, hit them kind of on the other side with what exactly it is and be very descriptive about it and kind of get them to see the creature anew if it's like a creature they're used to. So I try to build some subtlety into it if it's a creature that you know, it's special that I'm kind of liking as the GM.
With you were talking about what's to keep them from just like running up and just beating on it.
Right.
This came up whenever in the previous hour when we were talking about that. It's just like, sure, you can go and attack it, but when you do, you're making the fight harder. Other ways are monsters who can break your stuff. Like, hit with the sword. Oh, look, my sword broke. Guy in the next round might not do the same thing. So, I mean, I really don't like penalizing players for stuff like that. Like, this kind of thing is more satisfying than breaking your gear. But things of that nature that, you know, make it real obvious that, okay, the direct... You know, direct attack is maybe not the best ploy. We should think of something else.
Yeah.
And in designing a monster with that, it's always good to have kind of a little, way, like a weak spot that the players, if they're clever enough, can exploit.
Yeah, weaknesses and other things like that, like things that don't typically do much, like can do against the particular monster, kind of say to the players, like, okay, going up and swinging with your sword a bunch of times is good, but if you do this, it's even more effective and has less risk and that kind of thing. Some of the examples being like, you know, having a holy symbol against a vampire, that kind of stuff, where it's like, yeah, normally you would never just go up to a monster and wiggle your holy symbol at it, but in this particular case, it's a thing that you might consider doing.
Rhythm.
For this creature's spot, face, head, what kind of consideration goes into it? Goes as an abbreviated stat block in this one, or setting up its own separate creature?
You mean the heads off
yeah,
of this ability? Yeah.
I could see going either direction with that. If this were going in the back of, let's say, a Pathfinder Adventure Path Bestiary, where we have 2 pages to go, you know, to deal with it, if you were pretty conservative, you could probably keep this thing down to like one column, maybe a column and a half, and then you'd have a whole page, or well, you'd have art, but you have a little bit of stuff to describe it, so it depends on how much space you want to use, how much like word real estate you want to use. I could see an abbreviated stat block that you could probably do in like 5 lines, but I also wouldn't be opposed to having a whole stat block for it if you could come up with enough compelling, interesting abilities to justify that.
Yeah, you would really need to balance the cognitive load of asking the GM to essentially run these additional stat blocks with this monster with it being worth actually having a stat block that is giving enough information that's required for the encounter. I'm really thinking about the role the monster is supposed to play and to whether those types of details are really that necessary for it, or if you want it to be a little more of a big, scary, monstrous thing. But it does this ability, and then these little heads are part of that.
And sometimes when you're, especially if like the heads are going to need some kind of stats because you need to know whether you can hit them and that kind of thing, sometimes just having its own stat block just makes that way easier to parse than having a variable.
Yeah, than having a big, big chunk of text. We had a question up front, and I think there's a question right there. So.
Sure. So earlier you talked about the process you might go through for balancing a monster in first edition to make it so that it's not too hard or too easy and doing basically what you want it to do and the difficulties that you have to go through for that. Can you talk at all about what process you might go through in second edition to create a monster for balance purposes?
I think in both cases you're going to be looking at the benchmark numbers and kind of estimating from there, and you're going to be looking at spells, that kind of thing, to make sure that they're on par first level. I think that's true of both editions. The thing second edition does differently is that you don't build everything up through hit dice and feats. You take the benchmarks and you can adjust
Great.
The numbers as needed.
Okay.
So it's just kind of a little more direct toward the final numbers.
So you kind of reverse engineer it a little bit.
No. I would say that's more the first edition approach, at least how we typically do our best series, because we know what where we want those monsters to get to.
Okay.
We're not really building them organically, like hit die by hit die. We're kind of saying, we want it to be like this. Here's the hit dice and the feats and everything we need to get there and the ability scores. And in second edition, we're kind of saying, we want it to be here. We're going to put it there.
Got it. Cool.
Did you have a question there?
Yeah. So I was like looking at like the art of like Shaylock over there. And so like the green like goop stuff or whatever,
mm-hmm.
right? I was like, how could that be incorporated? And at first I was like, oh, well, duh, it's green goop stuff coming from a spider, it's gotta be acid. But I'm like, it's kinda boring. So like what if it was like kinda like a hyper evolved like stem cell kind of thing, like it offered like a small like regeneration proc, right? But at the same time it added like a telepathic link between like the person who interacted with it and Shaylob, because then it's like, because then she like she's like, oh yeah, you think that's cool? Come over here, and I'll give you some dope knowledge, homie. And you walk over, and it's like, bow. Now you're mind controlled and disgusting clones of yourself.
Sounds delightful.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a good point too. Kind of like synergizing the monster's theme and abilities together. So like,
mm-hmm.
if you're going with the thing where it is. A little more benevolent, or at least feels a little more benevolent, than having that kind of thing where it's like, this is good for you, you will like it, kind of it feeds into its overall theme. And whether it decides to betray you or not after that, it's kind of depends on how you want to run
it. We've got about 5 minutes left, so we'll get as many questions as we can, and if you can keep them short, then we can get everybody in. So we'll go you, and then back there.
Okay. Sports just for the monster. If you base the heads off of the Grasping Corpse spell, that would probably work pretty well for the attack, where it's basically a spell that here's a combat maneuver bonus for a trip or a grapple, and then here's its AC and hit points. Once it's dead, the creature's no longer tripped or grappled.
Question for Taylor Fisher. What is this software you're using?
This is actually... It's Procreate. The question probably is not
mine.
Procreate?
Great. Right there.
For managing stat blocks and the logistics of that, I know it's a good page space saver if nothing else, even if it makes a little more work for the DM.
Mm-hmm.
You could say its heads are, use the stats of a giant spider, but like, or use that, this mother of secrets, but it has the young template and it doesn't have the spawn proof ability.
Yeah.
Or just something like that.
And usually, like, some of those, if they require a little more work, like the young template one, that would be like, if we want these spawn to be really important and significant threats of their own, then we might do that. Whereas the grasping corpse one is what we would use if it's like, we want these to be dead simple and we don't want them to last very long.
Mm-hmm. Or just use the other monster just to say it's reasonable.
Yeah, a lot of it all depends on how significant we want that extra threat to be.
Sure. We have another question back there.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was remembering what the guy in the front said earlier about maybe this guy, when she dies, sprays out some sort of pheromone.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when it does spray it out, it actually attracts the male species of this lady spider. You know, they could be at a lower CR, maybe not easier to kill, but a lot more of them, like an ant.
Oh, yeah.
So my question is, whenever you design monsters like this, do you also keep in mind maybe the familial bonds of its of the members of the species, like children or the spouses or whatever?
Sometimes, absolutely not for every monster, but sometimes when it feels relevant or seems like an important part of the critter.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we look to kind of the real world analog. So like in this case, you know, like you said, if it's kind of like an ant colony and the monster is a little bit arachnid-y or insect-y, then we might go that way. But like we probably wouldn't think as hard about it if it were like a species that doesn't have a lot of dimorphism or is based on, you know, monsters that are frequently solitary in the wild in the real world.
Yeah, definitely in the back matter monster write-ups, there's the whole habitat ecology section in which there's often space to talk about, like you said, just sort of like the reproduction method of the monster and like, do they live in colonies? Do they have parents? Like, are their parents young? You know, how do they reproduce? How do they take care of their young? And, you know, sometimes the alignment kind of affects that, or the intelligence affects that as well. So it can definitely be like an interesting story hook to figure out exactly like how the abilities work or vice versa. Let's see, we have 3 more minutes. So anybody else have any other questions or comments? No? All right, well, we'll go ahead and call it.
Yep.
All right. Thank you guys
Thanks
so much.
Thank you for joining us for another PaizoCon 2018 seminar recording. Special thanks to the KDCon team, including Justin Sluder, Ryan Hiller, Stephen Glicker, and the entire Roll for Combat crew. No Direction's PaizoCon coverage would not be possible without their tireless effort. To find this and other great Pathfinder podcasts, visit nodirectionpodcast.com.